5-inch push-pull oscilloscope. So it's an old one. So I'm just trying to learn about it, I guess. Doug K2JJ sent me a very nice book in regard to it, but now I'm actually trying to use it and see what comes out on the scope itself. For instance, if you would have, like, I hooked up a speaker, like a little 3-inch speaker. I was actually going to use it like a microphone, and I hooked it up to the vertical input and the ground. What kind of a line would you see come across on there? I was expecting to see some kind of a sine wave come out, but it looked like a horizontal line, and it was just deviating just a horizontal line just going higher and lower and higher and lower as I would talk, or even lower across the speaker. You know, you'd see the line, this horizontal line move up and down a little bit. Would you expect to see that? I thought I'd see some kind of a sine wave. You know, it's got a coil in it. It didn't work out that way. I was kind of surprised when I set it up. You know, I set the control on the lowest frequency. It says between 15 and 180. I guess kilohertz. I guess the no, it's probably not close. It's probably 15 or 100 hertz, I guess, is the setting. Is that what you would see, Dick?
Okay. First of all, a loudspeaker as a microphone is a pretty small signal device. Many oscilloscopes are not going to have enough sensitivity to give you very much vertical deflection when you set the oscilloscope at the highest gain mode. And in the case of the Heathkit oscilloscopes, which had a final tube, which is a 12BY7, I think it was, push-pull pentode tube, the slightest amount of gas in that tube would start burning up the cathode resistors on that push-pull final stage of the oscilloscope, and it would start drifting across the screen. And so you need a pretty healthy 12BY7 tube, but that's still the tube that's being used in that rig, and you got to worry about the health of that cathode resistor, which when you open up the scope, you may find that cathode resistor is quite charred because somebody had a gassy tube in that location in past experience with that Heathkit oscilloscope. When you've got a good source of microphone, maybe with a preamplifier, and enough real signal to give you a significant deflection, when you've got the oscilloscope vertical sensitivity set pretty high, which really means you're turning it, I think on most oscilloscopes you turn the vertical sensitivity to the left in order to go from 1 volt per centimeter down to half a volt, down to 0.2 volt, down to 0.1 volt, and so on. You're going to go to the smallest number to get enough sensitivity with the direct connection. Then in the case of human speech, if you're whistling into your loudspeaker, which is a microphone, at a 1 kc rate, you'd like to set the sweep speed, the horizontal deflection rate, at something like a millisecond per centimeter or so, or even slower. If you set the horizontal sweep speed very fast, then you will see just a horizontal smear of the signal, and what looks like a horizontal line moving up and down. When you set the sweep speed horizontally a lot slower, even to the point where the screen flickers a little bit, then you will see the real up and down plotted. But what's part of what's going on here, Paul, is that the loudspeaker as a microphone is putting out such a small signal, it is not crossing the threshold where the oscilloscope can give you good synchronization. Until you get at least a centimeter or two of deflection on the screen, most oscilloscopes will not give you reliable sync. Without reliable sync, you're not going to see a repetitive sine wave. You're going to see something that crawls around quite a bit. So a little more playing around with the controls and worrying about the health of that push-pull final tube and the cathode resistor. These are some of your concerns. Back to you, Paul, for any further questions. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, that's enough to go by now. You know, I have different kits here I could put together, like signal generators and things like that. I'll work on that. Just one question. I'm not really sure what the vertical gain and is the control for that, and the horizontal gain. What does that give me when I turn those dials?
Okay. If you had a 1 volt sine wave, now let me backtrack. Let's assume you pick up a 6.3 volt filament transformer. So the secondary is 6.3 volts RMS, which is around, let me think now, square root of 2 times 6.3 is probably around 8 volts. So a 6.3 volt filament transformer, 6.3 volts RMS coming out, is around 16 volts peak to peak. If you set the oscilloscope vertical gain to be 2 volts per centimeter, then that filament transformer connected to the front panel would give you 8 boxes of vertical deflection, peak to peak. So the strength of the signal and how much vertical deflection you've got and what gain number you set on the vertical knob, which is usually rated in volts per centimeter, and I think in the Heath kit it might be a continuous, potentiometer instead of a real click-click control. I don't remember. Last time I used one of those was in the very early 60s, and they're not very popular these days. Nowadays, everybody wants a fancy digitally controlled Tektronix oscilloscope, maybe with sampling function. And so oscilloscopes have come a long way, Paul, as you're slowly finding out. A modern-day oscilloscope almost is automatic. You plug in a signal, and it adjusts its vertical gain and horizontal sweeps rate almost automatically to give you a beautiful display. But so vertical gain, high and low, depending on how strong the signal is coming in the front panel, determines how much vertical deflection you get. The horizontal deflection, you set it to be proportional to the rate of the signal. Now, if I'm looking at that 6.3 volt filament transformer, which means it's generating pretty close to a perfect sine wave at a 60 cycle rate. One cycle of 60 cycles is around 16 and two-thirds milliseconds of time from beginning to end. So that if by some magic you could set the horizontal sweep rate of the oscilloscope so that it covers the screen in 16 and two-thirds milliseconds or a little bit longer, that you would have one or a little bit more than one complete sine wave across the screen, representing 16 volts peak to peak, and one sine wave if the synchronization is working right. If your synchronization is not working right, even though you got the horizontal sweep speed set correctly, the signal will crawl across the screen. It won't sit still, and it's more difficult to interpret. So it takes a fair amount of playing around with the controls, with various sources of signals and various kinds of signals before you become familiar with an oscilloscope. It's going to take a significant learning curve, Paul, but in my opinion, it's a good investment. It is, other than a digital voltmeter, of all the instrumentation that's used in every real laboratory, a digital voltmeter is pretty high on the list. The second highest thing on the list is an oscilloscope, and the third thing on the list is going to be a spectrum analyzer. Good laboratories make a lot of use of those three instruments. So it's a good thing to make an investment with. Just keep playing with it in all kinds of ways. Make sure that yours is working correctly. There's various ways of confirming that. But simply touching the oscilloscope probe with your hand will pick up 60-cycle hum of signal that's present in your house. And particularly if you put your hand near a fluorescent bulb, you'll see all kinds of signals on the screen that will require some interpretation, but it's good practice. Back to you, Paul. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening.
Okay, very good. Yeah.
Is 10:01.
Definitely seems like fun. I got this years ago from Ed K2RIW, and he, it was no book. It's been sitting here. And I decided to put it in the shack. I played with it a little bit in the beginning, but I was lost. But since I got this book from Doug, I've been reading through it. And yeah, it did say something in the book about this, timing the horizontal, so you could wind up with one steady sine wave. so that must be the one you were talking about, the horizontal control. See, this book is, in other words, it's not specific to this model. It's, you know, in general with the, you know, about the heat kit. So I'm trying to interpret what I'm reading and apply to what I'm really looking at here. So we'll do that. Yeah, I looked on the internet at what they have out there with the new oscilloscopes and beautiful looking and all kinds of functions and things that are way over my head. You know, there's more buttons on there than you can shake a stick at. I couldn't believe what I was looking at when you make the picture bigger and you're looking at the oscilloscope. Wow, you know. But you're saying they're actually better. I know the prices are way up there. Unbelievable. I put my model in eBay just to see if anybody was selling it. I found one, and the starting price was $39. So, you know, I figured I could experiment on this thing without worrying too much. One other question. Can I ruin this thing by turning the dials one way or the other too much? If I plugged it into a 110 outlet, you know, I know it's supposed to be supposed to have capacitors in line. I understand you could do that. Can I do damage to the scope itself by basically by not knowing what I'm doing? Back to you, sir.
In general, using the controls on the front panel and twisting them in various combinations, in general, you can't create damage. The worst you can do with the controls on the front panel is possibly set it into some mode where there is no deflection and you're getting a bright dot in the center of the screen and you might burn a hole in the phosphor if you leave it that way for a couple of minutes. That's the worst you can do, and it's unlikely. I don't recommend you connect the 110-volt line directly to the front panel as a signal. There's a bunch of reasons you don't want to do that. The worst situation would be if the 110-volt line has got a hot lead and neutral, and if you plug it in such a way that the hot lead is going to the case and the neutral is going to the semiconductor of the input connector, your case will now be 110 volts above ground, and you put one hand on the case and the other hand on a radiator or a water pipe, and there may be no more WS2N. So be a little bit careful on that one. You can take some pretty big signals into the front panel, but as big as 120 volts, with all the current that your LiPa can supply, be careful with that one. Now, put it through a filament transformer first, where you bring it down from 110 volts to 6.3 volts. Now it's pretty safe. So, in general, you can't get hurt by using the front panel controls. Really big signals, maybe you could damage the front-end attenuator, and that's what you're really doing when you're setting the various controls on the vertical side to different gains. You're changing how much attenuation you put between the source of signal, the amplifiers, and the vertical deflection plate of the scope. There's various little transistorized oscillators you can build. By the way, heat-kit oscilloscopes at one time were extremely popular. There are people out there who just love collecting antiques. If you find the right website, somebody has got the owner's manual for that heat-kit oscilloscope on the website that you can download or buy a Xerox copy of it. I do recommend you get a hold of the owner's manual and read the operating section. Heathkit wrote in the old days some pretty darn good manuals that, although two-thirds of the manual would be concerned with how to build the thing, what resistor to plug in next and where to put it, and how to read the color code and how to properly solder, most of the Heathkit manuals, after you constructed the thing, they gave you quite a bit of information as to how to use it, what to look for, and how to know when it's working properly. So I do recommend you try to get a copy of the actual manual of your particular oscilloscope ball. If you intend to keep it, that's a good thing to have. And nowadays, that shouldn't cost you very much. Anything else you'd like to know about your scope? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. I'll definitely not plug it into the one time. You know, it thought crossed my mind. I said, ooh, what? I know I can get a 60-cycle thing out of that and take a look at it. I won't do that, Dick. good idea. I'll run it through a transformer. Got all kinds of transformers here that I could do that with. Just one quick question. You said filament transformer. What is that? Is that, you know, that term I've really never heard of. I know what a filament is, but a filament transformer, is that something special? What is that?
Okay. In the old days, long before you were born, Paul, we all used vacuum tubes. The vacuum tubes work because there's a hot filament. That hot filament gets heated up by either 6.3 volts or 12.6 volts. Those are the two most popular voltages that ran the heater or the filament of a vacuum tube. In fact, that the cathode ray tube on the television set that's in your living room and the cathode ray tube that's on your display device of your computer is running at 6.3 volts. Where does the 6.3 volts come from? A filament transformer. A filament transformer is intended to power the filaments of vacuum tubes. They almost always had 120 volts primary winding and a 6.3 volt secondary winding, sometimes with center tap on the 6.3, sometimes it's 12.6 with center tap, where you got 6.3 volts on each side. So the filament transformer does two or three things. One, it takes 120 volts and cuts it down to 6 volts. Two, it gives you isolation because it's got a primary winding and a secondary winding. So it gives you safety. Number three, the filaments of a whole lot of tubes in a particular radio might draw a total of 3 amperes. So the filament transformer is stepping down. It's got great big thick wire on the secondary winding. It has no trouble dishing out 6.3 volts at 3 amperes all day long without even breathing heavy, if you know what I mean. So a filament transformer, a popular device 30 years ago, was something that was about a 4-inch cube of iron with about 5 or 6 wires coming out of it. Two of the wires were quite often black, and that was intended to be the 120 primary. The 6.3 volt secondary usually was green, two green wires, and if there was a center tap on the secondary, it would be a green wire with yellow stripes. So filament transformers, just like skate keys, don't exist anymore. I mean, people don't have steel roller skates that they attach to the bottom of their shoes and tighten it on with a skate key. So you can't buy a skate key anymore, and it's quite difficult to buy filament transformers. But us old geezers, we remember the good old days, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
My comment from N2EL.
Go ahead, Rich.
Oh, I beg to differ. If you own an amplifier like my Ameritron, there are two transformers in there. There's a Peter Dahl high voltage transformer to the plate supply, and they've got a separate filament transformer. I forget, you would know what the 8877, I believe it runs on 5 volts and draws quite a number of amperes on the filament.
Yeah, something like 5 volts at probably 5 amperes or so per tube. Almost 25 watts goes into the filament of that tube. So it's a pretty healthy transformer, separately dedicated to doing nothing but firing up the filaments of the tubes. That's what a filament transformer is, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, very good. It sounds to me like all these filaments were being powered, well, with 5 or 6 volts, but AC. They had no diode set up in between.
AC2MDP.
Absolutely right. MDP recognized. The filaments of almost all radios that were powered from the 110-volt line were running on AC. The filament was doing nothing but heating up the cathode. It's a resistive wire inside the vacuum tube wrapped inside the cylindrical device called cathode. The cathode was insulated from the filament. The cathode had a separate pin coming out of the tube, and the cathode was coated with fancy chemistry so that when it gets hot, it easily emits electrons in order to make the vacuum tube work correctly. So yes, only battery-operated radios had DC voltage on the filament. radios you plugged into the wall, 99% of them had AC voltage on the filament. KC2MDP, K2LIW in the SecNet.
Yes, Dick. Couldn't you use like a regular doorbell transformer? I know they, most of them are 16 volts, but they are AC. And a question, too, talking about playing with oscilloscopes. As a matter of fact, I was playing with mine the other day. I, basically hooked it to, an output of my scanner, and was watching that. And the funny thing, I hooked it to a regular single, 1.5-volt dry cell. And, the flat line just, jumped up a notch. Is that normal? I thought I'd get, everyone's talking about a square wave. Would they get that out of a battery? Back to you.
Almost all oscilloscopes will have a switch on the front panel where you can flip from AC coupling to DC coupling. If your oscilloscope is in the DC coupled mode, and if you had it set at 1 volt per centimeter of vertical sensitivity, and you pick up a flashlight battery and connect it across the probe of the oscilloscope, we'll assume now we're using a 1-to-1 probe. And by the way, the probes for oscilloscopes, the most popular kind of probe is a 10-to-1 probe, but there are some slightly more rare ones called 1-to-1. Using a 1-to-1 probe, and I connect it across my pen light cell or my flashlight battery, and I'm set at 1 volt per centimeter. If the oscilloscope is DC coupled and working correctly, at the instant I make contact to that battery, the trace across the screen will jump up 1.5 centimeters and stay there. If I have the oscilloscope in the AC coupled mode and I connect to the battery, I will see the signal jump up 1.5 centimeters and immediately settle back down, depending on what the time constant is for the AC coupling. I'll bet you the AC coupling on most oscilloscopes is set to have something in the vicinity of a 10 millisecond time constant. So within 10 milliseconds, it's come down to 63%. Within the next 10 milliseconds, it comes down 63% of that, and so on. So it very rapidly settles back down to the screen, back down to the bottom of the screen, even though you're still connected to the battery, if you're AC coupled. So each has its advantages. If I wanted to see the little bitty audio signal that's on the plate of my audio output tube, the audio output tube, the plate may be sitting at plus 150 volts. And at this particular experiment, the AC voltage on that plate might be 1 volt RMS. You set the oscilloscope in such a way that the 150 volts of DC voltage on the plate doesn't overload it. You're down at such a low gain setting that the 1 volt sitting on top of that will never see it. However, if you're using the scope with AC coupling, you connect it to the plate, the scope will instantaneously jump an amount equivalent to 150 volts, then it will settle back down, and now your 1 volt AC will be on the screen, and you could set it at 1 volt per centimeter, even though there's 150 volts of DC present. So you can see the AC coupling and the DC coupling modes of the oscilloscope each has its own advantage depending on what you're trying to do. I wonder if that makes some sense, Steve. KC2MDP, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it does. Yeah, I see it jump up. I didn't...
Long-winded. Repeater, time out, 47 seconds.
I heard everything you said on the input stuff, Bob, so not to worry. When you connect a simple piece of wire from the air into your oscilloscope, will you see anything? And that's a matter of what oscilloscope you use. If you use a really modern oscilloscope, which goes down to something in the vicinity of 1 millivolt per centimeter, and you just take a 3-foot piece of wire and connect it to the front panel, you will first see quite a bit of 60-cycle hum pickup from the room, because a lot of appliances in your house are all running on 60 cycles, and the capacitive coupling to that piece of wire is significant. And a good oscilloscope has got an input impedance of 1 megohm or more, some of them even 10 megohms. So it doesn't load down the wire and the capacitance, and you'll see a 60-cycle component, but you'll see a lot of other glitches. Put that piece of wire close to a fluorescent bulb, and you'll see a real fancy waveform, because what the fluorescent bulb is doing on each half cycle, the voltage rises until the mercury gas inside ionizes, the voltage jumps down to a much lower number, and that creates the light on each half cycle. The mercury vapor in there has to be re-ionized on each half cycle, so you get a very complicated waveform. So just a wire going in there. I know you'd like to say, I'm going to see radio signals. Well, not many oscilloscopes have got a fast enough response time to see the radio signals, and the radio signals are usually in the vicinity of a microvolt. And the most sensitive oscilloscope of normal vintage is either 1 or 10 millivolts per centimeter. So you can see you've got a 1,000-to-1 difference between real radio signal amplitudes and what the oscilloscope is sensitive enough to see. That radio, let me drop a second, because we're in the non-net mode. Your real radio, when you tune it to Winds 1010 New York, 1.01 megacycles, and you listen to that news station, between the antenna terminal of that radio and the loudspeaker, there's approximately 120 decibels of gain. A lot of stages there. And your oscilloscope doesn't have all that gain, and it's not tuned to that exact frequency like your radio is. So if you intend to see radio signals directly into an oscilloscope, you've got a couple of problems. Put your handy talkie alongside of that wire, and yes, you'll see some kind of a response into the scope, but not many scopes have a fast enough video amplifier that they can respond to 146 megacycles. They may be 20 dB down in response at 146 megacycles, and with a handy talkie so close, you're giving it a whopper of a signal, so you will see something. But you probably can't set the horizontal sweep speed fast enough in order to synchronize at 146 megacycles. Probably on a normal oscilloscope, without getting into the exotic models, the fastest thing you can easily sync to is a 1 megacycle signal, not a 146 megacycle signal. Back to you, Steve. KC2MVP, K2RIW in the deck tent. Wait for the beep.
KC2KXK.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, I tried the thing with the handy talkie too, yeah, and basically I got some crazy readings. It's very interesting, though. It really is. Back to you.
Okay, KXK, start over your name, sir, and then your question or comment. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. Good to hear you on the TechNet. Listen to you guys quite often. Limark member. I just had a quick question. You were touching about the fluorescent bulb and on the half cycle and how it excites the gas. I was just curious, I put enough of them in. How exactly does a ballast work to ignite the gases for the fluorescent bulb?
Okay, Keith. Your ballast transformer is a kind of an inductive kickback device. In other words, when you first start the filament, when you first start your fluorescent bulb, the old-fashioned fluorescent bulbs had they weren't the instant start kind. You had a real filament on the ends, and you turned on the equivalent of a filament transformer. It heated up those filaments that boiled away some of the mercury. It made a mercury vapor. The mercury vapor was capable of being ionized. The starting device that used to be in the old-fashioned fluorescent light bulbs would momentarily put the equivalent of a short circuit across an inductor. When the contacts opened and the short circuit was removed, the inductive kickback would put a couple of 1,000 volts onto the fluorescent tube, and it would start the ionizing process. Once you arc over the mercury vapor inside there once, you start boiling away more and more of the mercury, and the tube comes alive. You'll notice that many fluorescent light bulbs, if you happen to mount a fluorescent light bulb in your garage, and if your garage is unheated, and in the wintertime the temperature in your garage goes down to 30 degrees Fahrenheit, you go out there and turn on the fluorescent light bulb, and you may notice that it either doesn't come on at all, or when it does come on, it's extremely dim, and you have to wait about 5 or 10 minutes before where the fluorescent bulb finally comes up to full brilliance. What's happening is that the coldness means that the mercury that's in the tube is much more reluctant to boil itself away to form mercury vapor, and therefore very little mercury is taking the action of becoming a vapor, which is giving you an ionized path. Ionized means, let me drop, you put enough voltage across it so that you get the equivalent of an arc. An arc is an ionized path in air. And you're trying to create that kind of an arc inside of the mercury vapor that's in that fluorescent tube. And once you do create that arc, that means your voltage is high enough that you are literally yanking some of those electrons away from those molecules of mercury. So now you've got mercury, the nucleus of mercury molecules, with the electrons yanked away, disconnected from those molecules. That's what ionized means. And now you've got this conductive gas of electrons that are free of their mercury molecule nucleuses. And now the gas is conductive. Once the gas is conductive and arcing, it's producing a ultraviolet signal. The ultraviolet signal hits the fluorescence, hits the phosphor of the tube, which converts it back into visible light. That's somewhat how the mercury, that's how the fluorescent tube works. A little bit simplified, but it's some of the action. It's a fairly exotic thing. In many cases, you can take a small fluorescent tube and hold it near the tank circuit of a tube-type 100-watt transmitter and watch the bulb light up, connected to nothing. Just the RF field going through the mercury vapor will ionize it and start making light. It's kind of a fun project to do. You got to be careful because you're bringing it very close to a high voltage circuit, and there's some danger there. Back to you, Keith. KC2KXK, K2RIW on the TechNet. Wait for the beep.
Ah, very interesting, Dick. Enlightening, I must say. Questions. Now, if you take the fluorescent tube and you bring it close to an RF field, which excites the electrons inside your vapor, now, will your pins actually on the end of the tube become live? Because now you're creating an electric field inside the tube?
Good guess, and the answer might be no. If I've got a strong enough magnetic field created by the coil of the tank circuit of my 40-meter transmitter, I'm running a pair of 807 tubes, I'm producing 100 watts of 40 meters, 7 megacycles, and around that tank coil that's resonating for the plate circuit of those 807 tubes, or my 813 tubes, or my 4CX250B tube, if it's a Collins transmitter, around that resonating coil there is an extremely strong high-frequency radio frequency field. Near that coil, we probably have, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 1,000 volts per meter of E field. When that 1,000 volts per meter of E field goes through the glass very easily, because it's transparent at radio frequencies, and gets into the mercury vapor, the RF field excites the mercury vapor, arcs it over, the mercury vapor makes its ultraviolet signal, the ultraviolet signal hits the phosphor, and the phosphor lights up, and you say, wow, my fluorescent bulb in my hand, connected to nothing, is giving off light. If you put a sensitive voltmeter on the prongs on the end of the fluorescent tube, yes, you would see some presence of the 40 megacycle, the 40 meter signal, the 7 megacycle signal in my experiment. But that's not what's making it light. You're putting an RF field directly into the mercury vapor by putting it near that coil. Whether or not there's voltage on those pins no longer matters. I wonder if that makes some sense. Wait for the beep. You got it, Keith.
Oh, it makes perfect sense. I was just curious about the tips of the bulb. It's like when I'm working on a transformer at work, we have to isolate both sides, your primary and your secondary, because you don't end up with a backfeed. We do that numerous times because Con Edison calls us up. They a supply of 27,000 volts, and that gets stepped down to 4160, which goes into our reactor system, which distributes to all the different substations that we have. So this way, in case we lose one feeder due to the reactor system that we have, it'll be backfed, and you won't lose power for that particular station. So, you know, kind of asks us to open up the breaker that's on the secondary side of the transformer, so that when they're working on the primary side of their lines, they don't end up getting a backfeed off our net. So I was just, you know, curious if it was the same thing with the bulb. back to you, Dick.
When you open up that breaker, do you sometimes see an arc? And in the case of the very high voltage transmission systems for power for the grid network across the United States, in some cases the breaker is not only a breaker with a huge gap, but there is a local supply of high pressure air to blow out the arc. Because if you don't blow out that arc in a, we'll say, a third of a million volt transmission system, the arc will make the circuits act like it's still closed, even though you've got those two contacts 3 inches apart or 6 inches apart. So I wonder if you've ever seen any arcing when you open up any of those contactors. Back to you, Keith.
No, I haven't, actually, because you're tied into the network, which is supplying your power. So there's no call on that particular feeder. So you wouldn't get an arc. It would just be just taking a wire and just attaching it to, you know, that particular voltage. But there's no draw on it, so therefore you wouldn't get an arc. Because it's tied into the net system. So it's not drawing anything. But one of the buildings one time, we had to open up the breaker due to the fact that there was a problem, and we had to open it up on load. And it's supposed to be charged with a spring, and when you open up the stabs...
Repeater, time out, 65 seconds.
Anyway, thank you, Dick, and you have a good night.
This is W2VL Repeater.